This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 13th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the Commission on the BP oil spill looks at a temporary ban on drilling in the Gulf Coast and the continued use of chemical dispersants. The Obama administration announces a new strategy to fight the spread of HIV/AIDS. And we'll hear from Costa Rica, where an agreement to allow in U.S. military forces is prompting vocal challenges and a legal suit in the country.
The problem is that the Congress exceeded its powers and misinterpreted the agreement.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A judge in New York has cleared the way for the first civilian trial of a Guantanamo Bay detainee. U.S. District Judge Louis Kaplan ruled today that Ahmed Gailani was not denied a speedy trial, despite being held for 2 years at CIA-run black site prisons overseas and then almost 3 years at Guantanamo Bay before he was transferred to the U.S. Judge Kaplan also said that if Gailani was subjected to torture during his interrogation, he can seek remedy in civil or criminal court. And one current Guantanamo Bay detainee will stay there after all. A federal appeals court today ruled that Mohammed al-Adahi was, at the very least, more likely than not, a member of al-Qaeda, and that's enough evidence to warrant his detention. Legal analysts say that today's ruling may well make it easier for the government to keep the balance of detainees at Guantanamo right where they are. Yesterday, another Gitmo detainee, Canadian citizen Omar Khadr, said he'll boycott his military trial, calling the plea deal he turned down an excuse for the torture and abuse the government allegedly inflicted on him as a child. Khadr has been detained for 8 years since he was 15 years old. For the second time this year, the state of California and its governor, Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger, are being sued over school funding. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
Pro bono attorneys representing parents, students, and community groups filed suit in Alameda County Superior Court in Oakland, alleging that the state's school funding system is unconstitutionally unequal and inadequate. California law requires that the state provide children with a public education and that the state make education funding its first priority. According to the plaintiffs, low-income and minority students are affected more often than their wealthier counterparts by increases in class size, cuts in electives, layoffs of nurses, librarians, and counselors, and lower teacher quality. This is the second lawsuit of its kind in California this year. A spokesperson for Governor Schwarzenegger, a defendant in both suits, said that the governor is willing to work on a solution with the plaintiffs, but that, quote, funding alone will not solve the fundamental problems facing our schools, unquote. The two suits will be heard in Alameda County. Kelly Ramirez, FSRN, Oakland, California.
Six New Orleans police officers were indicted today on federal civil rights violations in connection with shootings on the Danziger Bridge in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. In the first incident, police allegedly fired at an unarmed family on one end of the bridge, killing one. Minutes later, on the other end of the bridge, they fired on two brothers, again killing one. They're accused of then trumping up charges against the surviving brother. Four officers and two supervisors face various charges related to the shootings and the subsequent cover-up. At least three of the officers surrendered to the FBI earlier today. A dozen immigrant youth in New York City are holding a 24-hour vigil outside Representative Nydia Velasquez's office, urging her to support the DREAM Act. Karen Yee reports.
The youth are targeting Congresswoman Velasquez over her refusal to support the DREAM Act, a proposed federal law that would provide a path to legalization for undocumented youth. Congressmember Velasquez serves heavily immigrant areas in Lower Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, and is the chair of the National Hispanic Caucus. She is also the only New York City representative who has yet to support the DREAM Act. Sonia Guinansaca is a member of the New York State Youth Leadership Council.
It's sad because, you know, her district is immigrant. She has also sits in the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Majority of, you know, the DREAM Act students are Hispanic. It's like, you know, why are you not representing, you know, the youth that you are supposed to represent as a chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus?
In June, members of the New York State Youth Leadership Council staged a hunger strike outside New York Senator Charles Schumer's Manhattan office. Despite the action, Senator Schumer failed to bring the DREAM Act to a vote. The youth say they will continue to escalate their actions until the DREAM Act is passed. Karen Yee, FSRN, New York.
The International Criminal Court issued a second warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir today, adding three charges of genocide to the war crimes and crimes against humanity charges it filed against him more than a year ago. The ICC judicial panel found reasonable grounds that al-Bashir specifically tried to destroy in part the Fur, Masalit, and Zagawa ethnic groups. It's the first time the ICC has leveled charges against a sitting world leader for genocide. And the lower chamber of the French Parliament approved a ban on full-face veils today by a vote of 336 to 1. Amnesty International condemned the vote, calling a total ban a violation of the rights to freedom of expression and religion. The ban now goes to the French Senate in September. Should it pass there, it then must be constitutionally reviewed. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The U.S. Department of the Interior has issued a second ban on deepwater offshore oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico after a first attempt was blocked in court. Gulf Coast businesses and some local politicians say a drilling ban will hurt the economy. The ban was the focus of some panelists at the second day of hearings at the Federal Commission looking into the cause of the BP oil disaster. The Interior Department's Michael Bromwich said that the ban is necessary to avoid future disasters. Bromwich explained to the panel that the temporary ban targets BOPs, or blowout preventers, like the device that caused the BP explosion in April.
This moratorium is defined in terms of specific technologies that are used, and in particular, BOP stacks. So the suspension, the moratorium, is directed at subsurface blowout preventers, which are much more complex control systems than surface BOPs. They're much less accessible for intervention and so forth.
Bromwich, who leads the new Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, said this ban would last through November 30th, 2010, but the date could be adjusted. But some local leaders speaking to the commission criticized the ban. David Comardell, mayor of Grand Isle, Louisiana, called the ban an added challenge to residents already facing a financial strain.
We're not going to get a vote, but I can tell you one thing. By taking everything away from us from the waters, I don't know what the hell is going to happen to us. Hoping that, we get some help some kind of way. We can come across, and, you know, $5,000 is nothing. And to come in and nickel and dime our people, that's not the way to do it. And remember, it's hurricane season. All our insurances are due. Flood insurances. The banks are calling every one of the people, every one of our residents to renew it. There's just no money. There's no money.
Panelists also questioned the continued use of chemical dispersants. The EPA's Matthew Stanislaw said the agency was concerned over what it called the skyrocketing use of dispersants, and in May forced BP to scale back the use.
EPA and the Coast Guard raised its concern with BP, and at a meeting on May 26th, we collectively required BP to ramp down to 75% from their peak usage. The directive that was issued limited BP to 15,000 gallons of dispersant to use subsea and barred them from using dispersant on the surface without prior written authorization from the FOSC.
FOSC is the Federal On-Scene Coordinator. Despite this directive, BP continues to regularly use surface dispersants. As Mother Jones and ProPublica recently reported, letters on the Deepwater Horizon website show BP requested and received exemptions to use chemical dispersants for the entire month of June, except for 3 days. For example, a letter dated June 30th requests dispersants to be used as the primary mechanism for spill response and requests to use 10,000 gallons. It's approved, signed by the U.S. Coast Guard. Meanwhile, in the latest effort to stop the gushing well, BP installed a new containment cap, and today engineers will attempt to temporarily shut off the flow of oil through a series of valves. Engineers will then measure pressure from the well to determine whether there are more leaks below the ocean floor. Today, the Obama administration released a plan to reduce the number of new HIV/AIDS cases by 25% over the next 5 years. The ambitious plan is part of a comprehensive strategy to combat the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the U.S. The plan shows the public's awareness of the disease is declining, and the number of new cases is particularly high in the South and among blacks and the poor, aspects the new strategy aims to address. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
There are almost 18,000 people currently on waiting lists to access treatment from the federal government's AIDS Drug Assistance Program. As states face budget concerns due to financial stress, money for the program has dwindled.
The math that my grandmother would have said, that no matter how you want to pull it, a twin-size blanket on a king-size bed, somebody's feet get cold.
That's Dr. Keith Rowlings, Director of Medicine and Clinical Research at AIDS Arms Peabody Health Center in Dallas, Texas. He says pressure on public clinics like his has grown in recent years as their ability to effectively treat the disease has attracted more patients, at the same time that state budgets are being slashed.
If you look at the sort of the robustness of Medicaid programs around the country, they do real well when there's, you know, states are flush, but when states are not, which is the current recession that we're having, or recovery that we're having, there is not that additional revenue. And so many states around the country are all struggling to figure out where they're going to come up with resources.
The administration announced their new strategy on Tuesday. It aims to reduce the number of infections by 25% in the next 5 years. Infection rates in the U.S. have been roughly static since the early 90s, at around 50,000 new cases per year. But the number of people living with HIV has steadily increased. On Tuesday, Director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, Jeffrey Crowley, said the administration has set sober goals.
In the past, there have been efforts to, quite frankly, set really aggressive goals, cutting incidence in half. And I think that we went through a very serious process and are trying to be honest about what we think is achievable. And so I think by setting a goal of 25% is aggressive but realistic. I wish I could tell you that we could set a goal of 50%, 75%. I just don't know how that we do that in the short term. And again, we're setting goals for the next 5 years.
The plan directs a bulk of resources to high-risk populations, such as black men and gay and bisexual men, as well as Latinos and substance abusers. It focuses on early treatment, which has been shown to be extremely effective, and it aims to decrease the amount of people who are infected and do not know it. Today, one in five individuals are unaware that they are living with HIV/AIDS. Some AIDS advocates are critical of Obama's strategy, saying its goals do not reach far enough. Christine Campbell from HousingWorks says she is disappointed that the strategy didn't include more immediate AIDS funding in the healthcare overhaul bill.
Even with healthcare reform, the Medicaid expansion does not go into effect until 2014. There is a plan that could have served as a bridge. We could have implemented the Early Treatment for HIV Act now as a bridge to 2014, but we chose not to do that. There were some immediate steps that could be taken to actually start making headway now that this plan does not choose to do.
The Centers for Disease Control, Department of Health and Human Services, and a handful of other government agencies will work to implement the beginning phases of the plan. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Both the Senate and the House are back in business today after a short break over the July 4th holiday. The Senate appears to have enough votes to pass financial reform legislation, as three Republicans have come out in support. Although they are on the verge of passing this monumental bill, the Senate's to-do list is long. And as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, time is running out.
One of the first items on the Senate's long agenda is passing financial reform. That column is about to get a check mark, as passage seems likely. In the past 24 hours, three Northeastern Republicans, Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe, both of Maine, and Scott Brown of Massachusetts, indicated their support. This is the last hurdle before the measure that reforms the banking system and creates consumer safeguards heads to the president's desk.
And I urge the Senate to act quickly so that I can sign it into law next week.
Although passage seems likely, the margin could be slim. Senator Snowe acknowledges that she is one of the few Republicans in support.
An initiative of this kind, you would hope to have broader support for a comprehensive overhaul in light of what happened in 2008 that would engender broader political support. But again, people have different perspectives on this issue and concerns, so philosophical and otherwise.
The Senate has become a creature of bad habit. Democratic legislation is opposed by most Republicans. Extensive persuasion and compromise with moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats sometimes enable legislation to squeak by. But sometimes that doesn't even work. And now the upper chamber is facing a backlog, including the war funding bill. The House of Representatives tacked on $10 billion in education funding. Senate Republicans say it's a non-starter. John Kyle of Arizona was emphatic in his opposition.
No. No, in a word. We'd like to fund the troops and not have a bunch of add-ons that don't have the emergency status that these kind of bills ordinarily require.
Another pending bill is an extension of unemployment insurance. That's been stalled for weeks.
We have to help families help our economy recover.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
I guess we could think of it this way. Wall Street reform is preventive care. Unemployment insurance is emergency care. Our economy needs both.
Republicans say they're worried about the deficit and individual reliance on the safety net. The Senate fell one vote short in a critical vote for unemployment insurance in June. They hope to have the votes with Senator Byrd's replacement. And that's not all. Energy is another item on the docket, but there appears to be little appetite for a large comprehensive bill that includes cap and trade or broad limits on carbon emissions. Senator Reid is crafting a bill that is more limited in scope. He explains three parts.
One will deal with the oil spill situation. Another will deal with clean energy and job creation, consumer savings. And a third will reduce consumption, which is vital to anything we do.
Since the bill is currently being drafted, prospects of passage are unknown. But a key senator who supports comprehensive energy reform, Independent Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, says he's not discouraged.
I'm encouraged about the direction which Senator Reid is going, let's put it that way.
So we've mentioned energy, unemployment insurance, war spending, and financial reform. That's a long list of things for the slow, methodical Senate to do before it leaves for its month-long break in August. And that's not everything. The Senate must vote on Elena Kagan's confirmation to be Supreme Court Justice. They also want to finish a stimulus for small businesses, an extension of middle-class tax cuts, campaign finance reform, and a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's a long, ambitious list to pass before August or even to plow through before the end of the year. The House has already completed most of this list. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Earlier this month, Costa Rica's Congress approved an agreement allowing U.S. military forces, including some 7,000 Marines and 46 Navy warships, to operate in Costa Rica's territory. Both the Costa Rican and U.S. governments say it's an important step to fight drug trafficking, but the deal has drawn criticism from within Costa Rica, from those who say it violates sovereignty and Costa Rica's constitution. Now it is the subject of a lawsuit that challenges the agreement in the Supreme Court. We're joined from San Jose by attorney Roberto Zamora. He successfully challenged the government over its support of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and he's the person behind the current legal challenge to the military agreement. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this important issue.
Costa Rica has no standing army. The U.S. personnel have been permitted in the past to have a presence in the country. How is this current agreement, the one that was approved on July 1st, different, and what exactly would it permit?
So the U.S.-Costa Rica agreement on joint patrolling against drug trafficking allows U.S. Coast Guard services personnel and vessels to come in, but it's Coast Guard, which is also a civil force, part of the police. And in this case, the Congress gave a permit for the military U.S. Navy to come in, with its vessels and its aircraft and all the armament they need. So it's quite different, because the problem is not the agreement. The agreement is okay. It allows Coast Guards to come in. But the problem is that the Congress exceeded its powers and misinterpreted the agreement, allowing military personnel to come in, which is forbidden.
So the difference, in the past, the U.S. Coast Guard has been allowed to be in Costa Rica, but the change now would be the U.S. Navy, which, of course, carries weapons and is trained for wartime.
That's correct. It is possible for U.S. Navy, Army, or Air Force to come into the country as established in the Constitution, but only for a matter of the right of passing. Like, they can come in the country and go out the country. They can even stay in the country. But they cannot perform any operation within the country.
Your challenge filed with the Supreme Court highlights a few specific legal violations. One of them is Costa Rica's right to peace. What is the right to peace under Costa Rican law, and how does this agreement violate that right in your perspective?
So the right to peace was established as a right in Costa Rica in 2008 through a judgment of the Supreme Court that recognized or acknowledged that right in Costa Rica. In one of the judgments, in the judgment that the court recognized this right, it said, and I'm going to quote, "Therefore, a country wishing to promote peace, both domestically and internationally, must take care to restrict the manufacture and or import of weapons and chemicals in their territory, flatly rejecting those that by their nature had been thought and created to promote the negative value of peace." And this is very clear. Like, a vessel that carry aircraft is meant to be used in a war, and the rest of the vessels that receive the authorization to come in to perform activities are military equipment. Thus, they are thought and meant to be used in a war. So it is totally incompatible with what the court has said relating to the right to peace.
Costa Rica's Ministry of Security says the U.S. role under this agreement is specific, that the U.S. is, quote, for the cooperation to suppress illicit trafficking, that's drug trafficking. Is drug trafficking a real problem there, and is there a legal, more productive way for the U.S. to be involved in these efforts?
I think none of us who oppose the Army presence here oppose the job they are doing against drug trafficking. I think we acknowledge that's a problem in the country, but what we are saying is that it has to be done through the appropriate means. There has to be draw a clear line, because one thing shall not be confused with the other one.
Robert Zamora is an attorney in San Jose. He recently filed a lawsuit with Costa Rica Supreme Court challenging a military agreement that would permit U.S. forces to operate in Costa Rican territory. He joined us from San Jose. In the Gaza Strip, thousands of people who want to leave the coastal territory lack passports. Although travel for Palestinians is restricted, with a passport, some can leave for medical treatment, study, and to visit family members. But a backlog of passport applications has been growing, and human rights groups say both the Hamas-led government in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank are to blame. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Nidal Abdu is a resident of the Nusayrat refugee camp. 4 years ago, Abdu was at a friend's house when Israeli tanks moved into the camp. When he attempted to escape, troops shot Abdo in the left foot. Because his injury still causes him pain and he can't walk or stand for long periods of time, doctors in Gaza have referred him abroad for medical care. He needs a metal rod to be inserted into his foot, but doctors here cannot perform that procedure. Abdo cannot leave Gaza to get his treatment without a passport, and so far, his 5 attempts to get one have failed.
After 3 weeks, another travel agent phoned me and told me that officials refused to issue me a passport for security reasons. I am a member of the handball team for the Nusrat camp, and thank God, most of the team members are considered to be Fatah supporters. And the Nusrat club is said to be affiliated with Fatah.
The Palestinian Authority says they don't issue or restrict passports based on political affiliations. Ghassan al-Khatib is the director for the Government Media Center in Ramallah.
The right to obtain a passport is a given right. Yet recently, the Interior Ministry has observed some cases in which the passports are used illegally. Therefore, applications for passports from Gaza are scrutinized. So there could be some delay in releasing a passport. But absolutely, there is no intention to refuse some passports on political or intellectual grounds.
The ministry recently said they are expediting the processing of pending applications. According to the Palestinian Authority, they issue 500 to 800 passports for Gaza residents on a daily basis. The PA also says they expect to send 15,000 passports by the end of this month. But Hamas officials claim that the Palestinian Authority is withholding or denying passports to anyone belonging to the Hamas party. Ihab al-Ghussein is a spokesperson for the Hamas's interior ministry.
Unfortunately, what is going on is a consequence of current division within the Palestinians, and the Palestinian resident seems to be the victim. Most of those deprived of passports include students or patients. Monthly, we need in Gaza at least 10,000 passports, and since August 2008, only 18,000 passports have been issued.
But rights groups in Gaza say Hamas is responsible for the problem too, accusing the Interior Ministry of confiscating dozens of passports from residents in Gaza. The Gaza-based Al Mizan Center for Human Rights has called on all parties concerned to stop what the center termed illegal actions by both Palestinian governments. Samir Zakut is the group's spokesperson.
The problem lies in two things. First, the Ramallah-based government has turned down Gaza residents' applications for renewal of passports or obtaining new ones. The Palestinian Intelligence Service in the West Bank turned out to be behind such refusals on alleged security considerations. Meanwhile, we were surprised that the Gaza-based Internal Security Service has confiscated passports of 45 Gaza residents who have already submitted complaints to us.
The Gaza Strip's 1.5 million residents have been locked down for more than 3 years as Israel continues to impose a border closure. Nevertheless, students, people seeking medical treatment, and those with residency permits in neighboring Arab countries can leave through the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing terminal, but only if they have passport. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Today's technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Scott Pham and Antonio Ortiz. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.